Hi, my name is Claire and I'm the mother of three teenagers with FASD.
I'm Jessica, a PhD researcher specialising in educational interventions for children with FASD.
And together we are the hosts of Spotlight on FASD, the UK's first podcast dedicated to shining a spotlight on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders.
FASD is a condition caused by prenatal alcohol exposure that affects hundreds of thousands of children across the UK.
And we're here to bring these conversations out of the shadows and make sure that no one living with FASD feels alone.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to the next episode of Spotlight on FASD. We are really, really pleased this week to be joined by the FASD research team at Indiana University. So they are from the School of Medicine, and they are going to tell us a little bit today about the research that they are working on and what that means for the world of FASD. So we're really, really glad that you could join us today. Welcome. Can I invite you all to introduce yourselves, please?
We'd love to do that. So thank you for inviting us. We're really delighted to be here. What I might do, if that's all right, so you're going to hear each of our voices, and those of you watching or seeing it, you'll get to have a chance to see that. Would it help if we gave a little bit of orientation around ourselves, and then we'll dive into our project, but maybe just about ourselves first. Does that make sense?
Of course. Yeah, that would be great.
Thank you. Perfect. So I'll go first, if that's all right. So my name is Tatiana Farood, and I am a researcher, as you say, at Indiana University School of Medicine. Depending on your audience, we're called the Crossroads of America, which we're smack dab in the middle of the United States with no ocean, no mountains. We don't have much to distinguish ourselves other than very flat land and friendly people. So that's sort of our placement in things. So let me tell you a little bit about why we study fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and why this is important to us. And we'll kind of give our different perspectives here. So I've been a professor at the university for a number of years, but about 20 years ago, I began to do my work in FASD. So I'm a geneticist by training. And 20 years ago, I think we couldn't quite imagine how we could be involved in studying genetics and its role potentially in FASD. So my work actually started as part of a consortium called the Collaborative Initiative on Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders. We call it CFAS. And I started, and Leah will describe this in the same way, started working in 3D facial imaging. That's where we started. And many people would say, why would you ever be a geneticist doing that? Well, at the time, we were just trying to even understand, how do you better identify individuals who have been exposed to alcohol prenatally? Before we can even start to think about genetics, we need to better be able to identify individuals. So that's really how that work started, is I got pulled into that group by a very impactful collaborator that I had here at Indiana University, who's now passed away, Dr. T.K. Lee, who said, this is an important question, you need to get involved and bring passion to that. And didn't take long for me to realize that that was indeed something that I could and should be passionate about, and there was great work to be done. So 20 years later, we're now able to also think about genetics, but that's sort of my initiation into FASD research, and glad to talk about it more, but wanted to give you just sort of that human aspect, and then we'll do a similar thing around the table, if that's all right with you. Leah, do you want to go next?
Yeah, so I work for Tatiana, and Dr. Lee, 20 years ago, he said he had the foresight to think ahead and say, small group of researchers, you're all working independently, send Leah your data, and we're going to show you the power of combining your data. And they did, and we could show them that, you know, each individual group by themselves, maybe they were looking at cognitive and behavioral differences between individuals exposed to prenatal alcohol and individuals who weren't, so that they could find these cognitive traits are different, and that could help them target interventions for those particular cognitive traits. And you don't care about cognitive traits that are not different between these individuals. So each group individually might find a small effect, or, you know, might not find any effect, but they don't have enough confidence to share it with other researchers in the scientific world and say, look, I think this is important to study. But when we combined all their data together, we could show now we have a significant difference for these variables, but not these. So we can now share that with the scientific world, and that can start, you know, getting the ball rolling in terms of getting science and interventions and getting help to these people. So, and I'm a statistician by training. So that's how I got pulled into this. And I was lucky. Tatiana said, keep working with this group. And I've been really thrilled that all of the investigators in CFAS are really dedicated and committed.
Fantastic.
Perfect. Janine, you want to go next?
Yes. So I have also been working with Tatiana and her research team for about 5 years now. I'm a genetic counselor. So my specialty is in helping to make genetics understandable. And I've also previously worked in, you know, the clinical medicine field in within clinics and directly with patients and families who have children with FASDs or even adults with FASDs. So I am interested in the actual, you know, medical histories and kind of going through how that relates to the genetics, and also in helping with some of the outreach and helping to make our study understandable and kind of explain what we're actually doing in terms of genetics.
Can I just ask, when you kind of accidentally stumbled into the world of FASD, because everyone kind of just finds themselves in that world, it's very rarely a definite, I don't know what I'm going to do. Did you find that it just completely, you couldn't get enough information about it, that it started to fascinate you?
So I'll jump in and say, I hate to admit that I didn't really know very much until Dr. Lee brought me to this group and said, you know, let's all talk about this important question. And I went to a meeting actually in Spain. That's where I was on 9/11, was a first meeting of a group bringing investigators together. That were interested in research to better understand, in a variety of ways, FASDs. I mean, that to me was in some sense a real eye-opening. I mean, I didn't understand the frequency. I didn't really understand a lot about the variation in terms of the findings that individuals might have, the difficulties they might encounter. As I did start to learn more, very focused on children. People were very focused on children and making diagnoses. Very little discussion about what about individuals who have to live with FASDs for their entire life? What kinds of challenges will they have? So I feel like it's sort of like an onion that you unpeel and you keep learning new things. Like you come in going, oh, I just need to scratch the surface and better understand this. And then you peel that away and say, oh my gosh, but there's so much more that I don't know and that we don't understand. Mm-hmm. And we need to raise that awareness more broadly in the world. And so that's one of the things that, at least for myself, that's what I have found. And I certainly don't want to speak for others, but that's certainly been my experience.
Yeah, I think it kind of it consumes you. Either you're either gripped and that's it, I imagine, for the rest of your life. That's what I, you know, I just can't get enough. And I seem to link everything back to it because it's just entrenched in part of everybody's lives. Everyone will, chances are you'll interact with somebody with an FASD at some point of probably every day, because we don't fully, you know, we've got a good idea and of the prevalence, but we, you know, we don't know for certain, but we know that it's beyond anything that anyone has come close to taking an educated guess at yet. So what do you hope to find, or what do you hope to gain from the research? Or is it something specific that you are working towards, or just?
All right, so I want to address that. Can I do one thing first? Can I let mm-hmm. Abby introduce herself, and then I'm going to come back to that question. Is that all right? I just want to make sure I've tucked it. Oh, Claire, we're going to do this because we're going to keep getting ahead of ourselves. I just want to make sure I haven't forgotten her over there, and then I'm going to come back to your question, if you don't mind. Yeah. Abby, if you will, introduce yourself, and then we'll tackle Claire's question.
Yeah, happy to. So I graduated from college in 2020, and I was looking for a job, and I was hired as a clinical research specialist for this study. So I kind of work on the coordinating side of things, working with participants to help them through this study. And before I came on, I didn't really know much about FASD at all. But through this study, I've really learned a lot and have, you know, become a passionate advocate for the community for sure.
Thank you, Abby. All right, so now I'm going to tackle your question. And so let me take a stab at it, and we'll bring everybody else in, because I think we'll take our onion and take it apart. So I described for you a little bit about sort of how Leah and I, at least initially, walked ourselves into FASD research. We began working with how can we collect images and facial images in particular. So as many people realize, that's one of the cardinal ways that individuals will begin to assess whether or not an individual likely has fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, is they'll do a dysmorphology and they'll look at an individual's face. Well, one of the challenges, of course, is, you know, not everyone can come to a dysmorphologist. So we began in this field by trying to figure out, how could we make it easier to be able to collect facial images? How can we begin to understand those facial images and identify more subtle features that might suggest or indicate that an individual likely has been exposed to alcohol prenatally? And so why do I tell you that as I begin to go into a genetic study? Well, one of the challenges that became clear from the work that we were doing with facial imaging is we didn't have a very good way to have a worldwide impact. We were carrying around a camera, originally a super clunky one. Leah has pictures of herself traveling to South Africa with this enormous box she'd have to unpack. Okay. And then it became smaller and smaller. Now we're talking about, you know, using, you know, cameras that are basically in our phones. But we really don't have a way to have a worldwide impact. So one of the things for the project we're doing is we wanted it to be what we call remote, do something that you can do online. And this is before COVID, where everybody was like, well, of course you want to do it online. This is 5 years ago, where everyone thought you had to do everything in person. So we think we're pretty timely. And so by having the opportunity to be able to engage people around the world, and our hope was very large numbers of individuals, we suddenly thought we could now start to think about genetics. So one of the challenges about genetics is it's everybody's different. Everybody's genetics is different. There's not like you can say, well, this your genetic is in group A and your genetics is in group B. There's so much variation in our genetics. It means you need large sample sizes in order to be able to glean through that and figure out what in genetics, what genes, what pathways might be important in fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So we needed to have a way to be able to collect large numbers of individuals. So doing this remotely, as I say, where people don't have to come in, they can do it all online, suddenly opened up that door. Now you might ask, what do we want to learn from genetics? And I don't want to be the only one talking, but I'll give you a touch, and others on this call will talk about this as well. When you take individuals, as you know, who have similar experiences in terms of patterns of prenatal alcohol use, to the best of our understanding, the amount of exposure, the timing of exposure during pregnancy, the outcome isn't uniform. We still see incredible amounts of variation. We can see, even within a family, individuals where we assume that exposure is quite similar, and yet the outcomes for those children or adults is quite different, whether it's around physical features, whether it's around challenges in school, whether it's cognition, whether it's behavior, whether it's health outcomes as they get older. It's not uniform. And as a geneticist, the first thing I think of is, could genetics explain some of that variation that we see? Perhaps not all of it, but is it part of the puzzle? Is it part of the puzzle that says why some people are a little more resilient, able to overcome that exposure, and other individuals were more susceptible, that exposure has had more of a deleterious outcome? So this project, and part of its focus, is to be able to begin to ask that question by collecting a saliva sample. So if somebody spits in a tube, for kids, that's usually one of the most fun things that they're going to do. We're able to get DNA, and we can begin to study that DNA to see if there's patterns. And those who we know people have been prenatally exposed, those who are, again, more resilient, have fewer features, and those who have more. It's all about sample size, though. That's sort of the biggest challenge, is you got to have large numbers of people. That's our project, kind of in a nutshell. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Yeah. It's really fascinating. And when you think about it, because I know obviously I have three children, the same background, and the difference is staggering between the three of them. Even though there's only 25 months between all three of them in age jointly, it's unbelievable, the difference. So I think I firmly believe genetics has to play a big role in it. And you know, I think we'll be researching this for many, many years to come. But it's just, it's really made me think there when you said that your very first meeting was 9/11, and you didn't really know what FASD was. And I think I remember exactly, well, everyone remembers where they were when it happened. And I wasn't all that far off going down my adoption journey. You know, I wasn't many years away from that. And I had to think that I didn't even know what it was. It was nowhere on my radar. And I was only a handful of years away from mothering three children through life with it. It's just that really, I don't know why, that's really, really just struck a real chord with me there. I think most people don't know anything about it. And, you know, what Jess and I always say is that's not to be criticized. It's just when we know better, we do better. And it's just as simple as that. Now we know about it, so we need to do something about it. And we need to do better than we've done before. So it's just, it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see and to hear the passion as well. And it makes me feel, it's odd, but it makes me feel oddly safe as a mother navigating teens through life with FASD and in adulthood. I always say that Jess is the brains behind our operation, and I'm like the real life front line. She'll tell you exactly the science behind it all, and I'll say, yeah, this is what it looks like at 4 o'clock on a Friday morning. So it translates. But it makes me feel so safe and protected and not alone to know that there are such brilliant scientific minds constantly working away on our behalf to find out as much as they possibly can. And I'm truly grateful for it. Really, really grateful. It makes me feel really comforted. And it's really important to me to share that with my children that, you know, and I know for a fact their response would be, why would they want to do that? What are they doing? but I know when they become adults themselves, they will appreciate it. So,
and Claire, that was, you know, one of the things that I was really struck by when I was invited to come participate and be a part of this study. You know, like I said, I've worked directly with families, and I completely understand the struggle of, you know, you ask these questions and you get a whole lot of, well, we don't really know, we're not really sure, a whole lot of non-answers, right? And you can feel very alone. That can feel very isolating. And I was really, really struck when we started about just how many people were part of this collaboration and how, you know, they were so far apart, and how the remote aspect of this really allows everyone to kind of talk to each other in terms of researchers. And it's not just one group doing one thing, but many different groups looking from many different angles. And that's really what we need in research. And that's what we need in order to get better answers, is for us all to be looking and sharing information. And I really think that's neat about this project. And I felt the same way when I first started.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you tell me where you want us to go next. I mean, I hate to say it, I feel like I could just end right there because I'm sort of but I want to tell you a little bit more about what we do, and
yes,
hopefully have people feel, you know, it's sort of this is a way to get involved. And so would that make sense? Would that be a good place to go?
Yes,
next?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant. All right. So let me tell you a little bit about that now. And Abby, I'll take a stab at it and you can correct me. That might be an easier way for us to do that. And then I'll make sure that we provide all of our information. So as I described, one of the first things we really thought was important was to be able to have a study that people could do from around the world and hopefully wouldn't be too overwhelming. So the first thing I'm going to tell you is, in a study like this, we learned that being too comprehensive is overwhelming. Okay, so we've had to redesign this study. So initially we were gathering, you know, we're at least a statistician, we wanted lots of data. We wanted as much data as we could get. And so the problem with that is that can be overwhelming for individuals to do. So for anyone who might be out there who might have done this study earlier on, we've tried to shorten things up, tighten it up, and make it easier. And I would say Abby has been the brains behind that. So if you come to our website, what you would do is, the first thing you do is, as in any research study, is you consent. What that means is you learn about the study, you decide if this is something you want to do, you learn what it's going to involve, and then you decide whether or not you're going to decide that you want to do that, and that's providing consent. First thing I want to describe about that is, what I like about this study is, a lot of studies say, well, you have to be between the ages of 18 and 45. This study says, you know, we're taking individuals of all ages. The key thing when you're doing informed consent and agreeing to do this study, though, is to know who is able to provide consent. Okay, and I want to bring that up early because I think it's a question that often comes up. So we're interested in individuals who are young. So we're interested in children. We're interested in adults. Okay, but a child can't consent to a study. So if they are over the age of 7, they can do part of the process, which is called assenting. That means the child is agreeing, that they would like to be part of the study, but they can't provide consent. They can't say, I'm going to do a study. That needs to be a parent or a legal guardian, somebody who has the ability to provide that permission. If a child is under seven, that's entirely going to be the parent legal guardian that's able to make that decision. What's important to think about with FASD research, and it's not unlike other areas, is even when a person is over 18, depending on the challenges that have occurred as a result of FASD, they may or may not be able to provide consent. So there are adults, and not just with FASD. I certainly don't want to say, I don't want to suggest any kind of, this can occur in a number of other disorders. There's still an individual who is legally responsible and needs to be the person who provides consent. So I wanted to first explain that, because I think we have to tackle that as part of our study when we're trying, you know, we're offering the opportunity to participate. So I want to make it clear where individuals who are participating can be individuals who are highly suspected to have been exposed to alcohol prenatally, so highly likely to have FASD. We don't require a diagnosis. You don't have to be able to say, I have medical records from this physician who says absolutely definitively. We have to do that because it's hard to get a definitive diagnosis, and we know that. But we are trying to make sure that there's at least highly suspected so that we are likely to have individuals who are likely to be appropriate for the study. Because one of the things that can be confusing is if we start mixing up other things that could be leading to difficulties later in life and trying to determine what could be important in fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. So I want to say that's the first thing you do in any study. First thing you do with us is figure out who's providing consent. And I wanted to just reinforce that we're inviting individuals of all ages. Okay. Then, as you can imagine, this is the part that you have to decide how much data you want to collect. You want to collect basic information. So we need to know about exposures. Realize that that can be challenging. Is there information about exposures? Is there information about just sociodemographic information about the individual? We want to get some basic information around other challenges from an individual reporting. What kind of challenges are they having, whether it's in terms of health, whether it's in terms of cognition, whether it's in terms of physical? We just are trying to get that picture of information. We do it through a series of forms that the individuals complete online. You can do it all at once. We also realize that life often does not allow things to be done all at once. So people can come back, do a little bit of this now, do another part of it next week. We recognize that it is really difficult to do all of this at once. So that's sort of the second step. Then the third step, which I've described to you, is where we're looking to gather information around DNA, but we also are looking to get a picture of the individual. So what we do next is we send a saliva kit. So Abby talks to each person who signs up, makes sure the individual understands what they're being asked to do. We think that's an important sort of sounding board back. Want to make sure you understand what this study's about. Then we send in the mail a kit that has a little tube in which you collect saliva. So for children, they often would need a little bit of help. Most adults, there's a little picture, it makes it pretty clear. Most people are able to do that. And again, that saliva is how we get DNA. And I mentioned pictures. So one of the beautiful things about people having, I think, high-tech phones these days is most phones now have a camera on it of sufficient quality that we want to take pictures both from the front of the person, so looking at the camera like I am right now, and also from the side. You might say, why the side and why the front? Well, if you, as we think about features of individuals facially that have been exposed to alcohol prenatally, some things we can see either easier from a profile, some from straight on. We have directions. We make it hopefully pretty easy for the individual to be able to do that. It's going to sound funny, but there's stickers that you're also going to put on your face. And you might say, well, good heavens, why would I put a sticker on? Well, we're trying to figure out how big your face is versus someone else's face. You can't tell that. If you just take it on with your iPhone, you can't actually tell that difference. So we tuck that in there. Okay. And then the next thing that we have that people can participate in is this is two different parts, is an initiative that we have with Dr. Sarah Mattson, who is part of the CFAS consortium, who's looking at trying to develop better ways to be able to do online assessments of so cognition, pencil and paper tests, and also potentially some behavioral aspects. So we have a new online component called Brain that an individual completes and hopefully is kind of fun. I don't want to say totally fun, but hopefully is made as fun as it can. But normally people go in and do pencil and paper tests, have to go into an academic center and have to go do that. This is now saying, can we do this all online? How are people able to do this? What are the challenges? How does this work? So we're partnered with her to have our participants able to do that. And for individuals over 18, we also have some health questions that we're asking as part of a project that we do with Dr. Claire Coles and with Dr. Joanne Weinberg, who are exploring what are the challenges of fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol spectrum disorders as individuals age. So we don't offer that last piece to kids who are eight, that you've got to be over 18 in order to be able to do that. Now, a key thing for everyone to understand is we understand that this takes time and that we understand that people's time is valuable. So there's also a way to get what we call incentive, or there's compensation at different points in this process. So when you complete the consent and do those initial forms, there's some compensation. When an individual completes the pictures and the saliva sample, there's compensation. When they do the brain, there's compensation. And our idea is, it's not that we're not saying do this for the money, but I do think it's a way for us to recognize that it takes time to do this, and people need or can't do other things because they're doing this. And so we think that's also an important piece of, I don't know if you'd call it, it's considered a benefit from the study, but we hope that it also recognizes for people our respect of their time. And that's kind of the big picture of the study. I guess I would just ask Abby, anything you feel like I should explain better?
No, I think you hit everything really well, Tatiana.
Okay, perfect. So now you better ask me questions, Claire and Jess. What didn't I do a good job on?
Jess has probably got some really clever questions, but I've got a question about, say it's an adult who's doing the trial with you, and so they send a photograph of how they look now. Are you interested in how they looked when they were younger?
Yes. Yes, that was fantastic question.
My children's, I didn't know my children had FASD when I adopted them, and now looking at the baby photos and the photos of them through toddlerhood, and we know that it's just a small percentage of people do have facial features, but my children did, but now it would be very difficult to pick them out. They've grown out of them so rapidly, so I was just wondering if you did look at younger photographs.
We will. So not everybody has that, but it's actually quite valuable if they do.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Jess.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, do you have any sort of early findings or anything that you're able to share with us? Have you seen any patterns, or, you know, is there anything that is pointing towards genetics at this stage?
So I'll tell you, the struggle we have is, so our target is 2,000 individuals. It's a great question. We've enrolled we're around 600 or so. It's still too early. The sample sizes are really small. That's partly why we're here, is it's sort of a call to action, because we know that we need larger sample sizes. We need to have more people involved in order for us. Anything we see now, we worry that it may not continue to be shown as the sample gets larger. That's sort of my hesitation. I don't want to be coy. I'm just anxious about providing false information and then not having it confusing people.
Of course. So from what I understand, you're looking at this from a number of angles and different perspectives as well, especially the different components and having different specialists come in along the way. So is there an element of the study that's looking at genetics in terms of like the presentation of the condition, like Claire was saying with her kids, you know, they're completely different, but we're all born with a 25-month period, which, yes, a lot of significant life changes can happen, but the biological mother within 25 months probably wouldn't have changes to have impacted that significantly. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I do. No, it's actually a great question. So one of the things you also, and I'll just toss this out, I say this just as general concepts. So, you know, you could have differences in terms of nutrition and environment. And what many people would describe as social determinants of health. I think one of the challenges we have is there could be quite a bit of change within a 25-month period in terms of that. So that's something that's very hard to try to tackle. You know, that requires these really long, you know, even attempts at questionnaires that I think you're sort of, because you're not really sure what you're looking at. So I do think, though, in terms of your question around sort of patterns and change, I guess not so much around the mother, but trying to think of a sort of a phenotype is, can we group individuals potentially around outcomes and trying to better understand if genetics contributes to that. An incredibly important question. I hate to say that would require a much larger sample size. And so that would be really my hesitation. But I think if I could just, and I think Janine's going to want to jump in, I can tell she does. But if you think about interventions, that would be incredibly important to understand trajectories like that. But I'm just worried the sample size we would need is just enormous. So that's maybe in a future phase, but I think it's an incredibly important question. Go ahead, Janine.
Yeah, so there are a lot of different ways to think about genetics, and there are some things, some changes in our genes that specifically cause a certain outcome, and we can predict what that outcome is based on that. But the majority of our genes actually work in combination with our environment, and so that's why this gets so complex. That's why we can't find one thing that tells us exactly what's going to happen, because like you said, there's all those different variables, and those variables work in combination with our genetics. You know, our genes are the instructions that tell our body how to do the different things it needs to do, how to build the different things, the different parts of who we are, and you know, as we're developing. But that, like I said, even in that time, interacts with the environment, all those different factors. So it can be very complex interaction. And so that's why we need quite a lot of people to see what those small little interactions, what all of those together may, what outcomes they may show. And so you're absolutely right. There's all of these different things that we can look at and are interested in looking at, hopefully when we, as soon as we get enough people.
Yeah, I find it absolutely like fascinating, and I'm really excited to see the results of your study come out at different phases. And I hope that it does continue for a really, really long time and provide some sort of, not necessarily an explanation, but some sort of direction as to why some individuals are impacted by FASD. I was talking to somebody, you know what? I was getting my eyebrows done last night. And the beauty therapist, she was chatting away to me, and she was like, oh, so what is it you do? And I started explaining. She's like, oh, that's interesting. I've never heard of FASD. And, you know, I'm sure many of you have found yourself in this position. You start explaining it, and you're like, oh, this is how it occurs, and this is the kind of thing. And she turned around to me and went, oh, that's really interesting, because my mum's been an alcoholic her entire life and has struggled with alcohol and drug addiction, and openly admits that she struggled all through her pregnancies with all of her children. And I just, like, I wanted the ground to swallow me up in that moment and think, oh my goodness, what have I just said? But she was then chatting away about her siblings, and she was like, well, none of us really seem affected. Like, you know, we've all got jobs and we've all been through school, and none of us are struggling in the way that our mother has. None of us have addictions or anything like that. And in that, you know, I don't know. I was like, oh, it's genetics. You know, it doesn't happen for everybody. I just panicked and I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, luckily she was nearly finished and I just scurried out the door. But no, then it's really hard to almost backtrack. But then you don't want to backtrack, because
I know, but that's the thing. You don't want to backtrack, because they need to be the absolutely normal conversations that you have. That, yeah. You know, we're trying to rid the stigma and anything like around it, and like, oh, that's absolutely fascinating. You know, because there's, we all know, and certainly like, so like I'm 46, and like, so in my generation, so you know, a lot of mothers who were pregnant then, truly, genuinely, there was absolutely no knowledge around of the fact that you shouldn't consume any alcohol, you know. So it is so common, and I think that there are lots of, you know, so many different factors, but genetics has to play a huge part in it. It has to. And the conversation that you have, as much as you wanted the ground to swallow you up, it is vital for us to have those conversations every single day with everyone that we possibly can, to normalize it. And, you know, to normalize the fact that, and obviously didn't phase her, she continued chatting about it, but you know, it's so important to be able to talk about it, but it still is something that makes so many people feel uncomfortable.
I totally want to reinforce that. I completely agree with you. And now you have somebody who understands and could potentially speak to other people about potential impacts of alcohol exposure during pregnancy. I mean, I think that's important. The fact that she's not identifying, I would argue, any outward features. That does not mean that they're, I would also just stress, that does not mean that they're not there. It just means she doesn't recognize it, but realize this is the first she's ever heard of this, okay? And so I would actually argue the individuals that we're interested in studying, because presumably we're looking at if there are features, they're probably, let's describe them as milder, more moderated. And so it would be important to understand, well, what are those? But also, again, to delineate the spectrum, okay? And so I think you did a great job. I think you've just raised awareness in someone, and I really hope she goes and talks with that about to her siblings. I think that'd be incredibly important.
Yeah, I really hope so. And you know, generally speaking, in every waking moment of my daily life, I get FASD into a conversation, and you know, I try and do that. I did fear walking out with just one eyebrow. You know, I did have a bit of a panic.
Well, it wouldn't have been good for this podcast. Let me just say that.
Could you imagine? But you know, I tend to have these conversations when I'm a little more in control of it and aware of what I'm saying and sort of, you know, in the moment, and I can frame it. And on that occasion, I just panicked and was like, oh my goodness, this one came out of nowhere. You know, this was completely unexpected.
My dream is that we never ever even need to give it a second thought, and we don't put any kind of a filter on a conversation like that. We just normalize it, so that if someone were to say, I drank through my two pregnancies, that the response coming back is, oh, right, well, that could be something worth looking into, because, you know, no shock or you did what? None of that. That's what we need to be rid of completely. So I think it's, you know, the idea is that you would never, that you don't want to ever even check yourself with a conversation like that. You don't talk about it to everyone, which we do. I think we're a little bit extreme, all we talk about, but it consumes you. It does. And I know certainly my daughter, my boys are like not really all that interested, but my daughter talks about it freely all the time. She identifies people in her peer group. You know, she can diagnose at 50 paces now. You know, she might know a little bit about background. She might know what's been going on, and then she can put two and two together, and she's like, I think that's what's going on. That's what's going on there. You know, so just if nothing else, we are bringing up a generation. It's going to filter through eventually.
Was there anything else that any of you wanted to add just before we close?
I do. I want to offer you ways to get in touch with us. Is that all right? I'd hate to leave without having done that.
Okay. We'll make sure everything is in all of the description boxes and links and everything like that as well. But yes, please do share that.
I just want to make sure that everyone knows the name of the study. So I'll first say it and then I'll spell it. So it's called DIGFASD. So DIGFASD.org. So if you go there, that's our website. As you say, you'll have that on there. You can also reach us at FASD@IU.edu. We would just love to hear from you. Love to have you participate, but just, you know, really part of our website and our materials are just around education as well. So I think it's important. I think one of an important message from here is part of our jobs is to make sure as many people as possible are aware of FASDs and are thinking about that and thinking about how we can help individuals, think about interventions and just awareness. I think that's, you know, awareness is power, as we know, in so many things these days. And would love to have people come to the website and consider being involved in the study. Glad to talk with them as well.
Yeah, we'll share it. We'll put it in the description on the YouTube video, and we'll share it on all of our social media and obviously in our networks as well. Share it as much as possible to get people, and I'm sure it will result in people getting in touch. So
that'd be great. That's
brilliant. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
The website, I just want to say the website also has lots of questions and answers that's written in hopefully everyday language, not scientific academic language. So if someone listens to this and they have another question, or we didn't quite answer a question about, well, why am I doing this again? Those kinds of questions are on the website.
Brilliant.
Questions and answers. Also, some people have trouble reading especially adults with alcohol exposure. So a lot of the information is in a video. Abby made three really great videos that explains what you do and how to do it. And you can even do the consent by listening to the video and then signing the consent form.
That's fantastic.
So all that's on the website in addition to actually enrolling in the study.
Yeah, and I do really encourage our listeners to share this information far and wide. And if we can get any individuals who we know have had some level of alcohol exposure to sign up to this study, we hope that we've been able to express the importance of it here. But just think 20 years from now when they have 50,000 people sign up and all this information and they're just drowning in statistics and the outcomes, the data that we can gather here is endless, really, isn't it? So I really, really encourage people to reach out and get involved.
We'd love to. And thank you. It was it's a pleasure to spend some time with all of you. It was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you all so much for your time. Oh, Claire, you're on mute.
I have no doubt that we'll speak to each other again as well.
I do too.
I'm not even going to apologize for the fact that I've had multiple children trying to get in touch with us during it. That's just real life. It's normal. It's real life. So it's, it is what it is. So might not even edit that out. Might leave it in.